is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll take a look at the update to the City of San Luis Obispo's Inclusionary Housing Ordinance, which goes to the City Council on Tuesday.
Inclusionary housing is a set of policies in order to promote affordable housing.
Also, join correspondent Tom Wilmer at Adam Savage's cave in San Francisco for a conversation about the upcoming Silicon. This is Silicon Valley's premier Comic-Con.
Jamie Heineman called me up and he said, "Hey, I just got a call from Television Network. They want to make a show called Mythbusters. You want to help me make a demo reel?"
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, July 18th, 2022. I'm Carol Tangeman. Once again, COVID-19 seems to be everywhere. The culprit this time is yet another Omicron offshoot, BA5, and this variant seems to be more contagious with a higher risk of reinfection. So, what does that mean for those of us on the Central Coast? KCBX's host Kim Foster spoke with Aydin Nazmi, a social epidemiologist and professor at Cal Poly, who served as a faculty fellow for the university's COVID-19 response throughout the pandemic. This is our first episode of Ask the Expert on Issues and Ideas.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Aydin. First of all, tell us about this Omicron variant, BA5. How does it differ from previous variants?
Thank you for having me, Kim. BA5 refers to the lineage number, and that lineage number is by phylogenetic grouping. So it is a genetic difference, and it's close enough. BA5 is close enough genetically to the common ancestor of the Omicron variant, and variants refer to one or more mutations that differentiate from previous variants of SARS-CoV-2. So you can think of it as kind of one of the flavors of Omicron, and BA5 is the most recent and currently the most prevalent in U.S. communities at approximately 65% of the SARS-CoV-2 going around.
Mm-hmm. So how long should you isolate with this variant? Is it different from the earlier Omicron?
Isolation requirements haven't changed. What I'm hearing anecdotally, and I'm not sure if there's any good studies on this yet, is that with BA4 and BA5, the two most recent common lineages of Omicron, it is slightly more difficult to test out after day 5 or day 7, as the CDC was suggesting. So the general isolation principle is 10 days.
And how long are you immune? I've heard with the earlier Omicrons, you have about 3 months, but with this new BA5, you only have about 2 months. Is that correct?
I'm not sure if we can put a hard and fast number on it, but immunity does wane with natural infection and with also vaccination. On one end of the kind of spectrum, on the extreme end, I've seen some clinical cases in the scientific literature that suggest some healthcare workers were reinfected after, 14 days of being infected with a previous lineage of Omicron. And there are newer studies out there that suggest these lineages of Omicron do reinfect with some frequency. So if I were to be infected with BA5, odds are really low that I'd be reinfected with BA5 within the next 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 8 weeks. But if it were another lineage, the likelihood goes up. Mm-hmm. So there is waning with time. We don't know exactly what those time periods are, but within a relatively short amount of time, after vaccination, the risk of infection starts to go back up. However, the risk of getting severely ill remains low. That is the bright spot with waning immunity. In other words, immunity against severe disease is much longer lasting than immunity from reinfection.
The symptoms of BA5, are they similar to the earlier Omicron?
The constellation of symptoms seems to be similar. BA5 is, according to the studies that are coming out, the most infectious strain that we've had, the most infectious variety of SARS-CoV-2, which is somewhat frightening when you think about when Omicron first came out and then when Delta first came out. In each iteration, what we've seen is more likelihood of transmission. And with BA5, we see a fair amount of vaccine evasion. Those are slightly different issues, but relevant to the question of denominator, right? So based on the total number of people that are getting infected, that determines what number are going to the hospital or getting severely ill. So with Omicron, what we saw was the original chatter with Omicron was that it's not as dangerous, don't worry about it. But then what we saw was it overshadowed the prevalence of Delta by, 300, 400, 500%, which means the denominator, the number of people getting infected, was really high. So even if the rate of hospitalization is lower, the absolute number is higher because we have so many more people infected. And because we are unsure of the actual statistics for BA5 because of so much home testing happening, much less reporting happening, it's difficult to say. We have seen in the last 2 weeks to 4 weeks an uptick certainly of infections, even though we know it's a gross overcount. And we've also seen in the last 2 weeks an uptick of hospitalizations, ICU stays, and also deaths.
So the best defense against BA5 is vaccines. I had heard the United States is looking at specifically Omicron vaccine that might roll out in the fall. So for people who have already been vaxxed and boosted, this is just another vaccine to help them in their prevention of getting this?
That's right. So if you think about the flu vaccine, for example, which changes every year, and it changes with the kind of viral milieu, and that's what's happening. And I estimate may continue happening with COVID as we enter what we might refer to as an endemic phase. In other words, a phase of the pandemic when you see far fewer big up and down spikes, and you see a continual undulating presence in the population over time. An endemic state is one that we also have with cold and flu viruses that we get all the time. And it's quite likely that SARS-CoV-2 will be in our population, in our human population forever. What the manifestation of that will be will depend on a lot of things, including evolution of the virus, new variants, frequency of vaccine recommendation, and so on.
You're listening to Ask the Expert on Issues and Ideas. I'm Kim Foster. Joining me today is Aidan Nazmi, a social epidemiologist and professor at Cal Poly who served as a faculty fellow for the university's COVID-19 response throughout the pandemic. So with these two, risk of reinfection and diminished immunity, the BA5 sort of a double whammy, is that a scary situation for students coming back to school in the fall? Whether it's college students or elementary through high school, what will that look like if the BA wave continues?
It's a similar situation as the one we've been in for about 2 years. Because of the nature of BA5, it is a little bit riskier. Anytime you have humans coming together in large numbers, there's risk for any communicable disease, and certainly for communicable disease such as SARS-CoV-2 and BA5, which is the most infectious of the bunch thus far. So whether you're talking about universities and colleges or schools, workplaces, any crowded area, right, as we've become accustomed to, is a potentially risky situation. Now, the good news is we know a lot more than we did 2 years ago. We have a lot more tools at our disposal, whether they be preventive, such as vaccines and other physical measures, or pharmaceutical measures for those who take ill, for those who become infected. So I'm not sure I would classify it as scarier than before, but it is as scary as any other COVID situation we've been in. And again, the good news is we're just so much more prepared now than we've ever been.
Mm-hmm. Because, though, of these increased cases, should we be wearing masks indoors, even though they're not mandated here on the Central Coast?
I think that depends on a number of factors. Individual risk tolerance being a really big one. Depending on who you are, depending on what your feelings are about the virus, depending on how willing you are to put yourself in a risky situation. The estimate for BA5 is that, well, whereas we're seeing something like 130,000, 140,000 cases per day in the country, that gross estimate could be up to 500,000 per day, which puts it at one of the larger peaks we've seen. So there's a lot of virus going around currently. And then if you look at the map, the CDC maps, almost the entire country is red, which means risk. So that level of personal risk tolerance, according to your own situation, your family situation, do you live with a high-risk person? How willing are you to put yourself at risk, given that putting on a mask, for example, is really easy, given that many situations, it's somewhat straightforward to keep a safe-ish distance from others. But if you're going to be in a situation where you have no choice but to be close to other folks, crowds, and, you know, everything is basically reopened again. So you can go to venues and concerts and stores, for that matter, not to mention schools and universities. The CDC strongly recommends, and California Department of Public Health currently strongly recommends, masking in indoor settings. I anticipate the variation of who will be using masks and for what reason will be all across the spectrum. But we are currently in what I would consider a wave, or at least a bump. And anybody with any sort of risk aversion, I think, yes, should be masking. And of course, undertaking the vaccine recommendations, certainly, because that at the end of the day is the number one thing that you can do to keep yourself from getting severely ill, is making sure you're vaccinated and up to date, which includes now includes being boosted.
Mm-hmm. The second booster was only offered really for people over 50, but now it seems like that has also changed as well. Is it worth it getting two boosters before this Omicron vaccine comes out, maybe in October?
Absolutely. And you mentioned the guidelines, and the youngest group of children were also recently approved. Mm-hmm. And the idea is to vaccinate as high a percentage of the population as possible, because viral dynamics, the way that viruses travel through communities and populations and the way they evolve, what really we're trying to do is minimize as much virus in the population as possible. Now, we've had so much presence of this virus over the last 2 years that it's been, and I will say that the virus has surprised us and impressed us in a lot of ways with its virulence and with its aggressiveness. The issue of vaccines, I tend to fall on the side of whenever you're eligible, get a vaccine. And I think what we'll see down the pike with the new research, the new types of vaccines coming out, and also FDA approvals, that the recommendations will change over time, probably in a matter of months. And eventually it may become what you mentioned earlier, which is a regular vaccine at some interval or frequency.
Mm-hmm.
As we learn more about waning immunity or post-vaccination waning of immunity, where you have kind of a curve that gradually decreases over time, reflecting how immune you are to infection, how immune you are to severe virus, I think the guidelines will change, as I mentioned, and I think probably the most important thing that any regular person can do is stay up to date, similar to what we do with children. We keep them up to date with their vaccines, and we go through their sequences, and we know how powerful of a tool in public health that is in keeping people safe.
Mm-hmm. Testing. There's lots of concern about home testing versus PCR testing and the accuracy. Are any of the home tests more accurate? Are they all sort of the same? And still, should you still go and get a PCR test if you test positive with the home test?
You could. PCR are gold standard tests. So those are the ones by which we judge the quality of other tests. So home tests and antigen tests are less precise, less sensitive. And one thing that's impacting our ability to gauge the severity of BA5 right now, besides the clinical manifestation, is just the raw numbers. I'm an epidemiologist, and that's my bread and butter. I want to know how many. And the good of having so many home tests available is that it is at your fingertips. You don't have to go anywhere, potentially putting other people at risk. You can find out in 15 minutes whether you're infected or not. If you're not confident with the accuracy or with the result, you can just take another one. And all that is quite good to have that at your fingertips. The downside of that is most home tests are kind of lost to the ether in terms of official statistics and data. And people like me, we love statistics because we, using that information, gauge where we are. How severe is BA5 epidemiologically speaking, in addition to clinically speaking? And that allows us to keep our finger on the pulse of the pandemic. And I think since home tests have come out, it has relieved a lot of people in a number of ways.
And confused us some of the time as well, yes.
Certainly. And I think there's been a lot of confusion in the last 2 years, not to mention with tests. But if I take a home test and I see a positive result and I want to have a gold standard confirmation of that, sure, I could go get a PCR test. What we are seeing, though, is communities are offering much fewer PCR tests to the general public, and they're still available, and they're just a little bit more difficult to come by. So I think the average person probably is not going to go to the trouble of, after having a positive home test, go out to somewhere to confirm it.
And so if you had a crystal ball, which I don't know if epidemiologists carry around a crystal ball.
I have one right here.
How do you think the pandemic will continue to evolve into the next year or so? We're not going to hold you to it, but, you know, what do you think?
That's a really good question. And I think the good news is that our vaccines and our ability to improve vaccines is quite good. And that means, I believe, well into the future, serious illness from COVID-19 will remain relatively low compared to where it was pre-vaccine era. And of course, that will have disparities based on risk factor. Even if deaths remain relatively low, hospitalizations remain relatively low, the folks at highest risk, whether they're older folks, immunocompromised folks, maybe folks that haven't been vaccinated, will continue to suffer at higher rates, just like they do for other diseases. Now, the question of infection and infection evasion based on new variants or lineages of SARS-CoV-2, that I would be less confident in answering 4 or 5 months ago, as I figured eventually we have to enter what I might consider an endemic phase, where instead of big spikes up and down, we have kind of undulations over time. Now, BA5, I believe, has already proven me wrong, and I've been surprised and proved wrong many times by this virus. So in terms of infection numbers and what those kind of up and down curves will look like, I don't know. But the best case scenario is that we get to the point where we do have low-level undulations across time. The worst-case scenario is that variants or lineages evolve that give us other Delta waves, give us other Omicron-like waves, which infect high numbers of the population. And like we talked about before, even if we have a situation where the clinical manifestation is relatively mild, if you have 10 million people affected, that's a large denominator. So even if 0.05% of the population is getting seriously ill, 0.05% of millions and millions of people still remains really high. So I think, as we've heard a lot throughout the pandemic, it behooves all of us to remain vigilant, and I think to be aware of our own personal risk, our own personal risk tolerance. And not only that, but again, in a communicable disease situation, those around us, who are we coming into contact with? Who do we live with, right? How willing are we to put those who are closest to us at elevated risk?
Good advice. Thanks so much for joining us, Aidan. You've been listening to Ask the Expert. Joining me today is Aidan Nazmi, a social epidemiologist and professor at Cal Poly who served as a faculty fellow for the university's COVID-19 response throughout the pandemic. I'm Kim Foster.
Will a change in San Luis Obispo city law lead to more affordable housing? An update to the city's inclusionary housing ordinance goes to the city council on Tuesday. Up next, Agenda Breakdown, host Kim Bishop will explore the ordinance, the proposed update, and what a housing policy change may mean for San Luis Obispo residents who want to buy a home.
Welcome to Agenda Breakdown, a podcast that explores how cities and counties make decisions and how you can have a say. I'm Kim Bishop, and today we're going to talk about San Luis Obispo's affordable housing policies. There are many reasons to love San Luis Obispo, but the cost of housing is not one of them. The median price for a single-family home in the city of SLO is now more than $1 million. The city's been working on this problem for a long time. In fact, in 1999, SLO adopted an inclusionary housing ordinance that was meant to increase the number of affordable homes. That ordinance is getting an update this week. On Tuesday, City Council will decide whether to adopt some policy changes that staff is recommending. Here to help us understand the ordinance and the proposed update is Rachel Cavesti of Cavesti Consulting. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me, Kim.
Well, first, I would love to get your help with some terminology. So what is inclusionary housing and how is it different than affordable housing?
That's a great question. I know a lot of these terms kind of get muddled in conversation and even in staff reports sometimes. So affordable is very much what it sounds like. It's basically providing housing that the bulk of the community can afford at all different income levels. Inclusionary housing is a set of policies in order to promote affordable housing. So it takes in quite a bit more than just providing a physical home. It provides zoning and in-lieu fees, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, and all kinds of other strategies to try to provide that housing.
I'm glad you mentioned in-lieu fees because, yes, that's another term that I would love some help with. The city's website says the city's committed over $10 million of affordable housing in-lieu funds to help with the development of deed-restricted housing units. What are in-lieu funds? And while we're at it, what is deed-restricted affordable housing?
Sure. So actually, I'll take that in reverse order. So deed restriction is a really powerful tool to maintain affordability in housing. First, let's talk about the difference between affordable housing and market rate. So market rate are those million-dollar homes that, you know, just float up every time we get more demand surges. Everyone wants to live in beautiful central California on the coast. And so the market rate just keeps going up here. Occasionally we have plateaus. Once in a very great while, we have a dip in housing prices, but mostly that's a trajectory that just goes up. So affordability, you know, that gap between the market rate units, which continue to escalate in prices, while wages for ordinary people typically don't escalate as rapidly, that's the gap that inclusionary housing is trying to bridge. So in order to do that, we can use deed restrictions, which means that you take a house that would ordinarily be market rate. Let's say, just for the sake of the argument, this will be a $750,000 home. And so it's brand new, built by the builder. But instead of putting it on the open market and selling it for $750,000, instead you'll sell it for, say, $400,000. So there's an actual deed restriction that's recorded against the property that says that this property won't be sold for more than, and then you'll get a number from the city, more than $400,000. Those deed restrictions typically phase out over time. So for example, maybe your $400,000 deed restricted house will be able to increase in selling price by 2 or 3% every year. So if you live in the house for 20 years, you don't have to sell it again for $400,000. You can sell it for more than that, but it will still remain far below the market rate units that are going up 8, 9, 10% a year.
Is San Luis Ranch an example of a recent development that has that sort of deed restriction on the housing?
It is indeed, yes. So San Luis Ranch, we very deliberately tried to create a number of different product lines that would basically form a ladder of affordability. So we partnered with People's Self-Help Housing to do the very, very low income housing for us. And then we have everything from studios to 1, 2, 3, 4 bedroom apartments to townhouses and condominiums to single family homes. So we tried to provide a range. And then the inclusionary requirement for that was at each of those, on each of those product lines, we had to deed restrict a certain number of them so that they would be affordable for everyone.
And what do the developers get out of that arrangement? What's their incentive to have deed restricted housing as a part of a new development?
So it's really important, I think, for the community generally, as well as for any new development coming in, to have a broad range of people involved. I mean, if you look at very old societies where, say, the old cities in the East Coast or even in Europe, people lived close by. You didn't have enclaves of very wealthy folks that were sequestered from, you know, everyone else. You didn't have, there have unfortunately been traditionally ghettos, but there was a lot more intermixing of folks from different parts of the economic ladder. And so I think the very first thing that developers and the entire community gets out of inclusionary and deed restricted throughout a project is just the ability to be a community for your teachers and your firefighters and your nurses, to live with your service industry workers, the folks who wait tables and, you know, clean up and all those things. And so you've got kind of everybody in the same neighborhood, using the same parks and schools and amenities. It's a really great way to enrich the community just by building the community. So that's one. And then on a more financial basis, developers get a density bonus typically for including inclusionary housing in their development. So instead of, say, instead of 20 units, maybe you'll get 22 if two of them are affordable. So it's a bonus for them as well.
And are most of these developments by people who are living in the area or from the area? It seems like the quality of life benefits that you mentioned would seem most attractive to people who have a connection to Slo County in particular.
So San Luis Obispo is pretty unique in that we have a lot of good builders and developers here. So we do see mostly local people that are developing these projects, which is great. They know the community. They know the folks that they're going to be serving, the people who are going to be living in these units. So yeah, I've always found it very gratifying that we don't have kind of the big bad developers coming in from Los Angeles or the Bay. Typically, it's folks that have lived here for decades and really know their community and know what the community wants.
I want to go back for a minute to the definition of in-lieu fees. Can you help me understand that one too?
You bet. So in-lieu fees, if a developer chooses not to build affordable housing on the project site where they're building the market rate units, they can choose to pay in-lieu fees, which are fees that are basically equivalent to the amount of capital that would go into an inclusionary unit on the site. And instead, they just write a check for those funds. That goes into the city's inclusionary housing fund, which is separated from the general fund and from all of its other resources, and is basically just squirreled away for inclusionary housing, which means that it can be used in other parts of the city by another developer and by folks like Havslo and People Self-Help, the affordable specialists in town.
You're listening to Agenda Breakdown. I'm Kim Bischoff, and I'm here today with Rachel Cavesti of Cavesti Consulting. So the existing ordinance that had deed-restricted units and other elements that were meant to result in affordable units did result in hundreds of affordable housing units. But in 2020, a consultant did a study and found that the housing market was still not meeting the affordable housing demand. I'm not sure we actually needed a study. We all know that anecdotally, but right. But now we have the data to support that. So does that indicate that the original inclusionary housing ordinance was a failure, or what went wrong?
I definitely don't think it was a failure. One of the things that the inclusionary housing ordinance did succeed at was, again, building that ladder of different kinds of units, so in all different affordability levels. So, however, you're right that the inclusionary housing ordinance, as it was originally composed, didn't end up generating the number of affordable units, particularly at very low and low income levels, that we had anticipated. And I'll back up a little bit here to explain that every 8 years, I think it's 8 years, the state sends out RHNA numbers. It's Regional Housing Needs Assessment numbers. And it basically tells every jurisdiction in California basically how many affordable units they need to generate for us to have the housing stock that we need across the state. So each community is allocated a number, and those numbers are based on very low units, which would be affordable for folks who earn under 50% of the median income, and then low, which is 50 to 80% of the median income. Moderate is 80 to 120% of the median income. So they're very precise numbers that we're trying to hit. And the original inclusionary housing ordinance for the city did not generate the numbers, again, particularly at the very low and low levels that we were looking for. Again, it was incredibly successful in driving the average size of units and average size of lots way down. I can tell you on San Luis Ranch, we actually ended up with units that were 500 to 600 square feet smaller average than we would have absent the inclusionary housing ordinance. So it does squeeze those units down to make them more affordable for folks at the moderate level. And so our workforce here in San Luis Obispo. But again, it was not successful in the very prescribed objective that it had, which was getting those affordable units at very low and low income levels.
Do you happen to know offhand what that median income level is, just so we can assign numbers to those percentages?
I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but the median income in San Luis Obispo County is about $80,000 a year.
And that's household?
And that's household, right. And so the median income in the city may skew a little bit lower because I'm sure that the census data captures the student population as well, but we can use 80 as a round number.
So then what is the city proposing? What's going to change with this update?
So there are some really beneficial things coming out of this update. First of all, the city in its original inclusionary housing ordinance distinguished between expansion areas, which are San Luis Ranch, Avila Ranch, Froom Ranch, which is coming, and the rest of the city. So they had different standards for those expansion areas. And there's been a big push in the last few years because we're such a small, tight-knit community for there to be citywide standards that apply to everyone, regardless of where you live and where you're developing. So they've made that shift from expansion areas being peeled off to a citywide standard set. So that was wonderful. The other thing that I think was really beneficial that they've changed is that they used to base their in-lieu fees on the valuation of the housing being constructed. So if you put yourself in the shoes of a developer, you know, if you're trying to pull permits in 2022 and having to guess what that's going to cost you by the time you finish the houses in 2025, right? It's a very squishy number. It's hard for anybody to transparently, even from a developer standpoint, transparently document what the valuation of that construction job is going to be. So instead of using valuation, they're now going to just have a flat fee per square foot, which is so much easier for the public to track. You know, you can just see how big the houses are, how big the apartments are, the condos are that are being proposed, and do the math. It's a simple multiplication exercise. So that's going to simplify staff's work. They won't have to try to scratch their heads and figure out, well, how did the developer come up with this valuation, and are lumber prices or are, you know, is the price of concrete going up, down, sideways? So it simplifies it enormously. Those were, I think, some really positive changes that are coming out of the inclusionary housing ordinance so far. And then there are things that I was a little bit concerned about, actually. That I think the big one being, this is going to sound very wonky, but a little gadget that we've had in the inclusionary housing called Table 2A.
Oh, yeah. And, I'm glad you mentioned Table 2A. That's what I keep hearing about. So thank you. Sure. What is Table 2A and how can we de-wonk it?
Exactly. Yeah. So Table 2A is embedded in the current inclusionary housing ordinance. And it's a matrix by which developers can decide to push their unit sizes on market rate units down to have fewer deed restricted units, if that makes sense. So again, putting yourself in the shoes of a developer who's building 100 units, and you would have to typically have 20 of those deed restricted affordable. If your unit size, the average unit size goes down significantly, you can cut that by 25% or 50%. So it generated more housing that was affordable to the city's workforce. But as you can imagine, that kind of pits affordable housing in the state defined way that that's used against the missing middle, lower end of the market rate. So they're eliminating Table 2A in the inclusionary housing ordinance. Our concern was that that was going to lead to housing units in San Luis Obispo that were just larger. If developers don't get any bonus or any consideration for building smaller units, they're going to make more money on a 4,000, 5,000 square foot house than they will on a 1,000 square foot house.
Yeah.
So we were a little bit concerned about taking that pressure off of the market rate units. But I'm being told by city staff that that table is not actually being eliminated for good out of the city's toolbox. It's just being moved out of the inclusionary housing ordinance into another portion of the housing element.
Okay, so some of the concern around Table 2A was that the thinking was that it was going to be removed entirely And the reality is that it's just being moved into a different process.
That's our understanding right now. Yeah. And obviously we have a whole host of folks who are very interested in making sure that that happens. So there are a lot of interested parties who really want to see the city continue to be so successful in generating market rate units that are on the lower end of size and the higher end of affordability.
My last question for you is, what impact do you think this update is going to have? Is it going to make a big difference in terms of the number of affordable units in this next cycle of inclusionary housing?
You know, I don't really think it's going to make a huge difference. And I hate to say that. I don't want to be defeatist. But actually, the reason it's not going to make a tremendous difference is because the state has done such a great job of late and promoting inclusionary housing. So the state is now offering a density bonus for developers who are willing to make their units smaller and to include affordable units. So I think what's going to happen is that most developers in our area are going to use the state bonus density bonus laws for affordable housing rather than processing things through the city's inclusionary housing ordinance. Having said that, it's still a very worthwhile exercise because it does set up and maintain the system of inclusionary housing fees so that it maintains that bucket in which developers who don't want to provide affordable housing on site can submit in-lieu fees that the city can use to develop that housing everywhere. And I would put in a plug again for our affordable housing manufacturers, because those folks, much like the food bank, and if you've ever wanted to donate to the food bank, they tell you that $1 of donation equals $7 of food. Yeah, we love that. Love that. And you can do much the same thing with housing. So because of the nonprofits networks at the state and federal level, they're able to turn those inclusionary housing dollars into, you know, multiplied funds by getting matching grants and other things that allow them to actually build more affordable housing with those in lieu fees than the developer can do on his own site. So that's a really important tool that we're still going to have in our toolbox. And I think that'll be useful for decades to come.
Thank you so much, Rachel. I really appreciate you taking the time to explain all of this. It's such complicated stuff. I think we need to have a separate conversation about state housing laws and why they have changed in recent years and how they're affecting communities. But for now, this is really helpful going into the meeting on Tuesday.
Thanks, Kim.
Now it's time for today's action item. You can access the proposed update on the City Council agenda and on Open City Hall, which is the city's online public engagement forum. I will link to both in the show notes. Questions can go to housing@slowcity.org. And of course, you can submit public comment by email, phone, or during the meeting on Tuesday. This won't be the last time housing issues will come up, so I recommend that you also subscribe to the city's e-notification list so you can stay informed about housing-related workshops, documents, and hearings. I will link to that as well. Today's episode was produced by Samantha Reardon with music by Wes Bishop. If you liked the show, you can go to agendabreakdown.com to listen to past episodes and follow us on social media. You can also find us and subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Kim Bishop. See you next time on Agenda Breakdown.
Santa Barbara County is in a housing crisis, especially for those in lower income levels. In the second part of our series, Out of Reach, Beth Thornton reports on the challenges of building affordable housing in Santa Barbara County.
That's the sound of renovations taking place at the People's Self-Help Housing property in Isla Vista. The apartment complex has 56 rental units for families and farm workers, and it's one of many locations operated by the nonprofit for low-income households.
I first moved to affordable housing at the age of 10, maybe 11. 2005. I grew up in Orchid, California.
Daniel Gomez grew up in an affordable housing complex managed by People Self-Help Housing.
My parents moved there because we were living in a one bedroom as a family of four people.
He says his father worked as a laborer for a construction company in nearby Santa Maria, so the new location was convenient for work. Gomez says he had his own bedroom, and there was a playground with a basketball court and good neighborhood schools.
It had basically everything you would want as a child or a kid growing up. I didn't really ever think that I lived in affordable housing.
People Self-Help Housing owns and manages rental units from Ventura to Monterey. They also have a home ownership program where families work to build their own houses. CEO and President Ken Trigero says the organization provides housing for people who earn 60% or less of the area's median income. According to the 2020 census, the median household income in Santa Barbara County is about $79,000. So the organization helps households making about $47,000 or less a year.
We're serving people who are working in agriculture and supporting the tourism industry, working in healthcare support, working in retail jobs.
Trigero says there's a growing need for affordable housing in the county, and that's especially true for year-round farm workers and their families.
At the properties where we already have farm worker housing established, we have pretty high wait lists. It's around six households that are waiting for each unit that we have.
He says it can take 3 or more years to build a new property. Finding land and securing grants from local, state, and federal agencies takes time. He says there's also a long process of permits and reviews before construction begins.
Where and what you can build is still fairly restrictive, not only in terms of the zoning that's different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, even within the county, but also, based on what the neighborhoods and communities want to see.
Trigero says affordable housing projects sometimes meet resistance from nearby homeowners. He says neighbors express concerns over parking or obstructed views, but he's optimistic the sentiment is changing. The Housing Authority of Santa Barbara also develops low and moderate income housing within the city limits of Santa Barbara. It currently operates 1,400 units with long wait lists. Executive Director Rob Fredericks says challenges include inadequate funding and a lack of available land.
Big problem is Santa Barbara's a built-out community. Even the entire south coast of Santa Barbara, it's a small sliver of land between the ocean and the Santa Ynez mountain range.
He says they're looking at some of their existing Housing Authority properties to see if it's possible to add more units. They also recently acquired an office building on land that will be redeveloped for low-income family housing. Like People Self-Help Housing, Frederick says Housing Authority projects also meet with resistance from community members who worry about increased density or building designs.
That's how we get across that bridge from community resistance is we meet with the neighborhood first where we're planning something and get their input, and then we modify our designs to what will work.
Daniel Gomez, who grew up in affordable housing, says that when families live in a safe environment with access to resources, everyone in the community benefits.
It's going to help families. It's going to help create leaders that otherwise wouldn't be leaders if they didn't have access to this affordable housing.
Gomez decided after college that he wanted to pursue real estate and property management, and he found his way back to People Self-Help Housing, where he currently works.
Not only am I learning the skill, but there's a mission behind it. There's the mission of helping people that are in lower income.
Despite the many challenges that come with building affordable housing in Santa Barbara County, People Self-Help Housing and the Housing Authority say they're committed to finding solutions for people struggling to pay rent. Next time on Out of Reach, we'll explore how the cost of housing affects decisions on whether locals stay in Santa Barbara. For KCBX, I'm Beth Thornton.
Out of Reach is made possible by a grant from the Sunflower Foundation. Then finally, join correspondent Tom Wilmer at Adam Savage's Cave in San Francisco for a conversation about the upcoming Silicon.
I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me at Adam Savage's Workshop Cave in San Francisco for a conversation about the upcoming Silicon, Silicon Valley's premier Comic-Con. Tune in for a fascinating commentary by Silicon's creative director, Adam Savage, and executive director, Trip Hunter. Adam Savage, ready to rock and roll?
Ready to rock and roll.
All right. Tell us about where we are. This is a mind-blowing, literal cave in San Francisco.
We are in my cave in the Mission District of San Francisco. It's a couple thousand square feet, a couple blocks from my house.
So if somebody could go inside Adam Savage's brain, this is what it would look like.
It is. And clearly what you see when you're in here is that I'm a high-functioning hoarder. The only reason we can actually sit here is because I had a shoot here last week and I had to get rid of a bunch of stuff. But it's a constant battle. Mm-hmm. I have a storage space a block away.
You live right nearby.
Yeah, I live a couple blocks away.
So this is the equivalent of your garage.
It is. And it's really, really dreamy. When I'm in television production, I'm able to be in this shop maybe a few hours a month. But since COVID, I've been doing 40 plus hours a week in here.
So that means more things have been created in here?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we went from releasing on Tested, my YouTube channel, we went from releasing one or two videos every week to seven videos a week. So hundreds and hundreds of hours over the last couple of years.
What do your YouTubes focus on?
It's on making.
And could be anything.
Anything. My definition of making is as broad as I've been able to make it, which is anytime you use your point of view to make something from nothing. It doesn't have to be a physical thing. It can be temporal. And so, yeah, I've done everything from shop infrastructure. Actually, the day after Thanksgiving, I came in here and did a 45-minute piece to camera about how I had learned and realized that there's no such thing as a measurement. And that was one of our most popular videos in the last 6 months.
Explain that.
Well, I spent a lot of time here over COVID dialing into my machine tools, my mill and my lathe. And a mill and a lathe are effectively, if society collapsed, you could rebuild them with these two tools. And I became a more refined machinist. I did what a machinist would call chasing zeros, getting to more and more precise refinement. So I've done everything from building shelves in here to building sculptures inspired by Moby Dick to talking about engineering like that.
That's so cool. It's so hard to stay focused with you.
Yeah.
Because everywhere I look, I mean, there's Star Wars, Darth Vader helmets. To the right, fascinated by the NASA space suit. And somebody said, you made that?
Well, so actually, yeah, I've been building, replicating, and collecting spacesuits for about 25 years now. But this one on our side here is the first time I've designed and built one from scratch.
Has NASA contacted you?
Well, I have a lot of friends over at NASA, and I have a long and wonderful relationship with some astronauts and some of the techs at Johnson Space Center and at the Smithsonian. So it's a long-term relationship I have with NASA.
Tell us about, like, the helmets. Why are they here? Did you design those?
No. Most of these are helmets from movies. We've got, like, samurai helmets, Kylo Ren, Star Wars helmets, diving helmets. I realized that my obsession with spacesuits is actually equivalent to my obsession with armor and, as well, safety gear. Every time we needed a piece of safety gear on Mythbusters, I researched and bought the best version I could afford of that safety gear. And I realized that spacesuits, armor, and safety gear are all the same thing. They're human beings engineering our own hermit crab shells and makes us, for better or worse, the most successful species on the planet. And I find that really inspiring.
Over your shoulder, tell us about that.
The armor there?
Yeah.
That is a brand new piece I just collected. Mm-hmm. That is a replica of Colonial Marines armor from Aliens. But this set was actually hammered out of aluminum by the original maker of the armor for Aliens. His name is Terry English.
Wow. For a moment, roll back in time.
Okay.
In your life, where were you a kid and were you a geek always?
Oh, yeah. No, I've always, so I'm the son of an artist and a psychologist. I was born and raised in New York City in Tarrytown, New York. And I was always encouraged to try different things, to make my own toys. And whenever I was really interested in something, my parents made efforts to put that in front of me. And I followed that same thing with my kids, who are now adults. The environment I grew up in was a very creative one.
So you get out of high school back in New York. Then what happens to your life?
I go to NYU and study acting for 6 months.
Wow.
At the NYU Tisch School for the Arts in the experimental theater wing. And then I dropped out I ended up getting a kind of an ersatz film education because all my friends at NYU were in the film department and I art directed films with them and I worked as PAs on their productions. It's a, you know, that's a whole plasma pool you jump into and don't leave for a few years. And that eventually led to working in theater and then in special effects here in San Francisco.
So when you came to San Francisco, who hired you? What were you doing?
So I was in New York. It was 1989. I was working as a graphic designer, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I submit that New York is a terrible place to be if you don't know your ambition. It will chew you up and leave you by the side of the road. San Francisco is a phenomenal place to be if you don't know what your ambition is. So I moved out here because I've always loved this city.
Did you have a job when you came?
No. I moved into one of my closest friends' apartments, and I got a job in theater. And that job led to being trained as a rigger, as a carpenter, as a stage painter. And that ended up leading to special effects, but none of it was planned. I came here thinking that I wanted to be a sculptor. Jamie Heineman, who I worked for in the 90s, called me up and he said, hey, I just got a call from Television Network. They want to make a show called Mythbusters. You want to help me make a demo reel? I think we could make a fun demo reel together. And what Jamie didn't know is that I had just bought myself the first laptop built for digital video editing, the Pismo by Apple. Spent the spring of 2002 teaching myself the rudiments of filmmaking. And so when Jamie called, I had this everything I needed. I showed up. We filmed for 2 hours. We sent that demo reel to Discovery, and they showed up 3 weeks later to film the pilots of Mythbusters. And we didn't stop filming until the late fall of 2015.
So Mythbusters goes away.
Yeah.
How do you reinvent yourself?
Just before we wrapped Mythbusters, I was hanging out with a friend of mine who was an actress on one of the CSI shows. She had been on it for 6 years and then left. And she said, oh, sweetie, your show is ending after 13 years. Get ready because you're going to go insane. And I was like, what do you mean? She's like, the life change will be really weird. And she was right. Right after we finished, I kept up a kind of feverish pace because that was the pace I had been doing things forever. And it took about a year for me to find a different pace. You know, my wife was like, do you have to bolt to the cave every day at 8 a.m.? And I was like, actually, no. And so now I go and get coffee around 9. I come in here around 9:30. It's a much more relaxed existence, but I had to learn that.
So in a new incarnation, Silicon.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, Silicon started as the first homegrown Bay Area con in a while. Steve Wozniak brought it to Silicon Valley in a few years. We went to every Silicon as tested, and I went in costume, and we built a really lovely relationship with the con. And then back in 2019, the con invited me to come in. And that felt, I think, both Trip Hunter runs the con, and to me, like a really natural extension of the friendship, the professional relationship, and the overarching goals we had, which was promoting letting people find their freak flag and flying it.
So it's to share.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I turned 50 5 years ago, and my kids moved out of the house, and I'm in that stage of my life where I can see that I'm on my long decline, right?
<yeah. laughs>
Maybe it's 40 more years. I hope it's 40 or 50 years.
Yeah.
But, you know, as soon as I felt that, I felt a real abiding need to pass on everything. You know, I love the cosplay community specifically because it is so deeply sharing based. And same thing with the maker community. That wasn't natural. That wasn't the way it started. There was a lot of gatekeeping in the early days of both movements, making and cosplaying. But I feel like the kindness won out. And at Silicon, we consider it one of our primary missions to promote that sharing and to reduce the gatekeeping until the threshold to entry is as close to zero as we can make it.
Talk to us about cosplaying as it relates to people that come to Silicon.
Okay. Actually, I'd like to talk about cosplay as it relates to all humans for a second.
Yeah, there you go.
Because anyone listening who's heard the term cosplay probably has an opinion that it's a little weird. And I want to point out that everyone listening has a favorite shirt or jacket or pair of shoes that when you put them on, life feels a little better. And that's all that cosplay is, just at a bigger scale.
Right.
The transformation I felt the first time I put on a costume when I was 10 years old, I dressed up as Fonzie from Happy Days. I felt, well, someone pointed out that because I only had a jean jacket, I was officially Chachi. But that transformation altered me and still continues to. And I've spent a long time both enjoying it and also examining it. And I think that as human beings, we are a couple of things. We are explorers and we're storytellers. We go to the edge of the known and we report back what we find. And the stories that move us, wherever they are, when we cosplay, we're literally pouring our bodies into those stories. And we're learning what we can about ourselves and about those narratives by doing that. And so at Silicon, the cosplayers that come show so much of a breadth of creativity and genius. And
give us some visual.
Yeah. The first cosplay that ever really shifted my whole understanding was I was at San Diego Comic-Con around about 2010, and I ran into a Hello Kitty Darth Vader, bright pink. And I thought, oh, wow, I really understand something I didn't before. These mashups of, like, how do I take this and make it my own? Mm-hmm. Because there's one thing to dress up as Darth Vader. That feels great. I've done that. But it's another to think, what does Darth Vader mean to me and where can I take it? That's a whole nother thing. So you get both at any given con. And it's so much fun to be on the floor of ours and watching people walk around. Also, when you've invested in a costume and you run into someone else wearing the same costume, you share an intimacy with them.
A brotherhood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know if you've ever hung out with someone you grew up across the street from but weren't friends with, but just growing up in the same location links you, and the costume work does the same.
So let's talk a little bit more in specifics about Silicon.
Yeah.
That's coming up.
Yeah, Silicon is coming up. It is the last weekend in August, the 27th and 28th at the San Jose Convention Center.
And do we want to have Trip jump in at some point?
Yeah, by all means. Let's wheel Trip up. Trip up.
Let's pack it.
No, I love this chair.
This is Trip Hunter, the CEO of Silicon.
Hello.
It's an incredible event. One of the things we try to do that makes our event a little bit different is to come up with a theme for it every year. And I don't think there are a lot of cons out there that do that. And our theme this year is creating the improbable. So much of what Adam's been talking about is this ability for people who come to be able to leave feeling empowered, right? Feeling that they now can take the first step in creating on their own. And I think that's a really important component.
Yeah, we want to stake out a claim as the Maker's Con. Mm-hmm. All cons are Maker's Cons, absolutely.
But this one, you have classes.
Okay. Not only do we have classes, we're actually going to devote a whole portion of the floor, a significant percentage of the floor, to a makerspace where we will have classes, workshops, demonstrations, hour-long contests. What can you do with a coat hanger in a couple of hours with cardboard? You know, when I meet people who want to cosplay but haven't yet, they always say, I just haven't figured out the right thing. I don't think I have the right skills. I don't know if I have the right materials. And I want, again, to lower the threshold to entry so that they take that leap.
That being said, have you had people show up that almost arrived by accident who were clueless and were transformed by coming?
Interesting. That's a really good question. I'm not sure about that. I will tell you, there is a kind of costume I see at cons all the time, which is the person who was like, I'm going to a con, and they grab some things they have around the house and they scotch tape some things on themselves. Like maybe it's a Captain America star on their chest or something. But the people who are doing that, who are doing a genuinely crappy thing, but they're doing it because they want to play.
Because that passion.
Yes. And that to me speaks so much volume about what we're all getting out of that experience. And they might worry that like someone will make fun of them because their costume isn't amazing, but that's not going to happen. You're going to run into people who are like, dude, yeah, Captain America.
And we were recently talking to a very interesting person, Jonathan Knowles, who used to be with JPL, and he was saying the maker definition is much broader than most people define it. Like a woman or a man knitting a scarf, they're a maker, right? And you need to be able to embrace all of those different platforms that people are passionate about.
Sewing is making, gardening is making, coding is making. I had a guy come up to the autograph. I used to speak at the San Mateo Maker Fair every year, and I would always sign autographs for 2 or 3 hours afterwards. And a guy came up and I said, what are you making lately? It's a question I ask everybody. He said, I don't make, I code. And I yelled, coding is making. And he burst into tears. Again, like, we're all part of the same journey.
What a wonderful morning. This is great. And I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Adam Savage's cave on a mysterious street in San Francisco.
Don't To listen to the hour-long podcast version of the story, check out Tom Wilmer's show page, Journeys of Discovery, on kcbx.org. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.